to On Science. I'm Richard Harris. This week, more from The Human Edge, our series exploring how we evolved into the beings we are today. We'll look at whether believing in God has given humans an evolutionary edge, also telling stories, a hallmark of the human brain, and the human search for meaning. But first, a story about scientists and an unusual case of heroism during World War II. During the war, German troops surrounded the Russian city of Leningrad, as St. Petersburg was known. Hundreds of thousands died of disease and starvation during the siege. During this terrible time, a small group of Soviet scientists guarded a rare collection of potatoes and plant seeds. They feared that years of research would be lost. The scientists refused to eat their precious collection, and they were among those who starved to death. 70 years later, their research institute is again under threat, this time from real estate developers. Here's NPR's David Green.
The Vavilov Institute of Plant Industry is in the same building in downtown St. Petersburg where those scientists huddled during the war. But much of the institute's work takes place 45 minutes away in a garden that holds clues to different strands of fruit, how they can survive harsh climates, and which ones make people healthier.
Let's go.
The curator of this collection, it's mine collection.
Leonid Burmistrov has been a scientist for the institute for 40 years. Out here in the village of Pavlovsk, hundreds of varieties of fruit and berries stretch across acres. Burmistrov studies everything.
Like the winter resistant to different kinds of the fungi diseases or bacterial diseases and so on. What is the quality? What is the taste? And so on.
Until this fall, when the Russian government plans to sell much of this land to developers. The gardens aren't what they used to be, and weeds have taken over in spots. But Burmistrov says these plants remain vital to science. The idea of ripping them from the ground?
No, of course. No, no. It's not possible to think about that possibility.
Through history, this institute has had a love-hate relationship with Russia's rulers. In 1940, Joseph Stalin imprisoned the institute's namesake, Nikolai Vavilov, because Stalin didn't agree with his genetic research, and Vavilov died in prison. In the Cold War, though, the Kremlin was committed to science like this as a way to outshine the U.S. Today, the man leading Pavlovsk, Fyodor Mikhovich, still calls himself a simple Soviet director. He's written to everyone, up to President Dmitry Medvedev, to try to save this place. Sounding nostalgic, he says communist leaders would have supported him.
This feels like deliberate destruction, a continuation of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, when famous scientists were destroyed, along with the science of genetics. Today, they want to bury the legacy of the genetics founded by the great scientist Nikolai Vavilov. What will we, the Russian nation, have to be proud of if we ourselves destroy this?
A court ruled that the law is clear. A government property agency can sell off agricultural lands like this. It's not clear how much land will be auctioned, but much of the fruit collection appears threatened. Scientists here say it would take years to relocate the plants, and developers are in no mood to wait. They're poised to build houses for St. Petersburg commuters. Andrei Anisimov is deputy director general of the government's Federal Fund for Housing Construction Assistance. He's been on TV making the case.
These plots are not being used. The buildings are neglected and going to ruin. That's why the commission has every reason to make this decision.
Scientists from around the world have rallied to Pavlovsk's defense. There's a campaign urging people to send Twitter notes to President Medvedev. And on August 13th, a surprise. Medvedev, or the manager of his account, tweeted that the appeals had been noted and that the president had ordered an 11th-hour inquiry. But so far, though, no final word from the Kremlin. Scientists say there are few places in the world like Pavlovsk, and many of the strands of fruit they've carefully developed might never be recovered. What's more, says Peter Raven, director at the Missouri Botanical Garden, there's the symbolism of a collection scientists died to preserve.
In doing so, they provided a real model of drawing a line in the sand for biodiversity that's inspired everyone.
Only not around St. Petersburg, where people are more fired up about stopping the energy giant Gazprom from building a massive skyscraper amid the city's historic palaces. Many brush off the Pavlovsk situation as something typical in modern Russia, a spat over property that will just end up making somebody very rich. There's also a perception that Pavlovsk was lost long ago. 78-year-old Antonina Krekstina lives nearby.
Look at these gardens. They're neglected. They used to have everything here, fruit and vegetables. Now there's nothing. Soon they'll probably have to sell potatoes just to pay their workers.
Some of the gardens could be auctioned off as early as September 23rd. All the while, Leonid Burmistrov, the veteran scientist, goes about his business, as he's done for 40 years. There's a new strain of blue honeysuckle he's working on.
If they say us, boys, develop this crop, we're ready. Let's go to the flowers.
David Green, NPR News, Moscow.
Does believing in God give humans an evolutionary advantage? Over the past few months, we've been airing a series of stories called The Human Edge about how we evolved into the modern human beings we are today. Now we hear about religion from an evolutionary perspective. We'll explore how religious beliefs might have helped us become the species we are today. NPR's Elise Spiegel talked to some scientists who spend their time thinking about whether belief in a supernatural God has given us an evolutionary edge.
Jesse Baring's mother died of cancer on a Sunday, died in her own bed at 9 o'clock at night. Jesse and his siblings closed her door, then went downstairs hoping that somehow they might manage to get some sleep.
You know, obviously we were all terribly upset, and my brother and sister and I were sleeping in the living room downstairs. And at about 7 a.m., 7:30 or so, the wind chimes outside of her bedroom window started to chime.
Jesse remembers waking from his long night and hearing the soft tinkle of these bells. And he remembers thinking that those bells carried a very specific meaning.
It seemed to me, sort of intuitively, to be a message from her. And I knew that my brother and sister were thinking exactly the same thing, that she was somehow telling us that she had made it to the other side, that she had sort of cleared customs in heaven, and she was telling us that everything was okay.
Now, Jesse was an avowed atheist. He did not believe in any kind of supernatural anything. He was a psychologist, a scientist, who believed only in the measurable material world. Still, he couldn't help himself.
My mind went there. It sort of leapt there. And from a psychological perspective, you know, as a psychologist, this was really interesting to me because I didn't believe it on the one hand. But on the other hand, I experienced it.
Why is it, Baring wondered, that even a determined skeptic could not stop himself from perceiving the supernatural? It really bothered him. It was a very good question, Baring decided, to take up in his psychology lab.
See, throw it just like that, but now throw it a little, and you're a little closer, okay? Yeah! All right, you did it!
This is from a video recording of one of the many experiments that Jesse Baring has done in the decades since his mother's death, attempts to tease out how belief in the supernatural affects human behavior. Baring is a professor at Queen's University, Belfast. In this experiment, children are instructed to throw a Velcro ball at a Velcro dartboard and told that if they're able to hit the bullseye, they'll get a special prize. But then Baring gives them a list of rules that basically make it impossible for them to win the game unless they cheat. Of course, the researchers don't really let on to this.
So you think you can do that? Let me see. I think you can.
Now, the children in the study were divided into three groups. The first was left alone and told to play the game as best they could. It was the same with the second group, with one difference. The children in the second group were told that there was someone special who was going to watch them. The experimenters showed the kids a picture of a very pretty woman, a character that Baring had made up, who, by the way, had the same first name as Baring's dead mother.
Maybe you have heard of her. Have you heard of Princess Alice?
We say that this is a picture of Princess Alice. She's a magic princess, and she can make herself invisible. That's what her magic basically is.
You know what invisible means?
And she's in the room with us right now. She's made herself invisible. You can't see her, but guess what? She's sitting in that chair right next to us.
So that was the second group. And the third?
The third group of children are basically shown an experimenter, a human being, actually sitting in that chair. So this person takes the place of Princess Alice, this invisible woman.
All right, let's see you do three more, following all the rules. The middle of the target.
Now, the question that Baring wanted to answer was this. Which group of these children is least likely to cheat? Remember, they've been given an almost impossible task. Well, the first group of children, the totally unsupervised kids, by far cheated the most. But what's surprising is the behavior of the second group.
Those children who were under the impression that Princess Alice was in the room with them were just as likely to refrain from cheating as were those children who were actually in the room with a physical, real, live human being.
A similar study with adults showed the same thing, that people are dramatically less likely to cheat when they think they might be observed by a supernatural presence. Now, before I explain why this is important, you should know that Jesse Baring has a credo, a truth he says he's learned over his years of studying this stuff.
I've always said that I don't believe in God, but I don't really believe in atheists either. Everybody experiences the illusion that God or some type of supernatural agent is watching them or is concerned about what they do in their sort of private, everyday, moral lives.
Of course, these supernatural agents might have very different names, what some call God, others call karma. There are thousands of names. But according to Baring, they all have the same effect.
Whether it's a dead ancestor, whether it's God, whatever supernatural agent it is, if you think that they're watching you, then your behavior is going to be affected.
And this is really important. In fact, Baring says that believing that supernatural beings are watching you is so basic to being human that even committed atheists regularly, involuntarily, have moments where their minds turn in a supernatural direction, as his did in the wake of his mother's death.
They experience it, but they reject it, sort of override or stomp on their immediate intuition. But that's not to say that they don't experience it. We've all got the same basic brain, and our brains have evolved to work a particular way.
Baring is actually one of a number of academics scattered around the world who about 10 years ago started to look more closely at the nature of religious belief. Without directly engaging the question of whether or not God existed, they decided to look at religious belief through the lens of evolution. You see, in the history of the world, every culture, in every location, at every point in time, has developed some supernatural belief system. And when a human behavior is so universal, scientists often argue that it must be an evolutionary adaptation, kind of like standing upright. That is, something that is so helpful that the people who had it thrived and the people who didn't slowly died out until we were all left with the trait. But what could be the evolutionary benefit conferred by religious belief? What does belief in the supernatural get you? Well, according to Baring and some of his friends, the answer to that question has everything to do with what he discovered in his lab, the way that the kids and adults stopped cheating as soon as they thought that a supernatural being might be watching them. Through the lens of evolution, religious belief sets us on the path to modern life by stopping cheaters and promoting the social good.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, is that Dominic? Dominic Johnson is a professor at Edinburgh University in the UK and one of the leaders in this field. And Johnson says, before you can understand the role religion and the supernatural might have played in making us the people we are today, you really have to appreciate just how improbable our modern lives are.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Have you stayed with us before?
Today we live in a world where perfect strangers are regularly incredibly nice to each other. All day long, these strangers open doors for each other, they repair each other's bodies and cars and washing machines. In short, they cooperate.
Hi, what can I do for you?
This cooperation makes all kinds of things possible. Because we can cooperate, we can build sophisticated machines and create whole cities, communities that require a huge amount of coordination.
Enjoy your trip and thank you for riding Metro.
Basically, by cooperating, we can do things that no individual or small group could do. The question is, how did we get to be so cooperative? For academics like Dominic Johnson, this is a real puzzle.
Explaining cooperation is a huge cottage industry. It dominates the pages of top journals in science, in economics, in psychology. You would think it's very simple, but in fact, from a scientific, academic point of view, it just often doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make sense because there's often a tension between the interests of the group and the selfish interests of the individual. Johnson gives an example, an experience he recently had in the subway.
When I was in New York last, I went down, put in my ticket in the barrier, and some little kid ran in with me and got through the barrier. So he got onto the metro and didn't pay. Now, we only have the metro if everyone pays, but there's an advantage for everyone if they don't have to pay themselves.
And what's true of the subway is true of everything. Why fight in a war, risk your own death, if someone else will fight it for you? Why pay taxes or reduce your carbon footprint? These all have clear costs, and from an individual's perspective, you and your offspring are much more likely to thrive if you don't get killed in a war or pay your taxes, if you behave like the kid in the subway. The problem is that even a relatively small number of people who choose to behave like the kid can affect the functioning of the whole.
Even a few cheats undermine cooperation.
Once people realize that they're paying for the same thing that other people are enjoying for free, they become much less willing to cooperate. Today, if you cheat, pass on paying Uncle Sam, steal a car, there are systems in place that will track you down and punish you. And this threat of punishment keeps you on the straight and narrow. But imagine if you lived hundreds of thousands of years ago.
We know that punishment is very effective at promoting cooperation. But the problem for human evolution then is, well, who punished in the past before we had police, before we had courts and law and government? There wasn't anyone formally to carry out the punishment.
In those early communities then, when someone did something wrong, someone else in the small human group would have to punish them, maybe a leader, maybe just one of the group. But punishing itself is often dangerous, because the person being punished probably won't like it.
That person has a family, that person has a memory, and it's going to develop a grudge. So there are going to be potentially quite disruptive consequences of people taking the law into their own hands.
On the other hand, if there are gods or a god who must be obeyed, these strains are reduced. After all, the punisher isn't a vigilante. He's simply enforcing God's law.
You have a very nice situation. There are no reprisals against punishers. And the other nice thing about supernatural agents is that they're often omniscient and omnipresent.
If God is everywhere and sees everything, people behave. They curb their selfish impulses even when there's no one around. Because with God, there is no escape.
God knows what you did. God is going to punish you for it. And that's an incredibly powerful deterrent. If you do it again, he's going to know. And he's going to tally up your good deeds and your bad deeds. And you will suffer the consequences either in this life or in an afterlife.
So the argument goes that as our human ancestors spread around the world in bands, keeping together for food and protection, groups with a religious belief system survived better because they worked better together. We are their descendants. And Dominic Johnson says their belief in the supernatural is still very much with us.
Everywhere you look around the world, you find examples of people altering their behavior because of concerns for supernatural consequences of their actions. They don't do things which they consider bad because they think they'll be punished for it.
Of course, these are all just ideas with no real way to confirm any of it. Unfortunately, it's not possible now to rewind the movie, so to speak, and see what actually happened. And so these speculations will remain just that, speculations. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
Humans have been telling stories ever since we began talking. Stories have become a kind of tool, as powerful as an axe or an arrow. In this story from our series, The Human Edge, John Hamilton reports on how seeing the world through stories affects what we do with our lives.
Not so long ago, Sean Parker was waiting offstage at a club in Hollywood. He was about to stand in front of hundreds of people and tell a story he'd been working on his entire life.
I was so nervous, I felt like I wanted to throw up.
It was more than stage fright. Sean says what was at stake for him was pretty much everything.
So I'm like, this is it, right? This has been the dream to come out here. And there's actors, and there's writers, and there's directors out here, and the people that are true storytellers, because I'm just some guy coming from Wisconsin.
Menasha, Wisconsin. It's a smallish city on the northern tip of Lake Winnebago. It has lots of paper mills and good sledding in the winter. And that's where Sean's story begins. Sean Parker was born in 1969. He's the youngest of four children. When he got to eighth grade, a teacher had the class write letters to themselves. The topic? How they saw their future lives.
I wrote well, you know, what do I want from the future? I guess find somebody that I love and work in a mill, get a house, and have some kids.
That was pretty standard for kids growing up in Menasha. And it was pretty much what Sean's father had done. 4 years later, Sean's teacher sent back all the letters. When Sean read his, he realized he'd already started rewriting his future.
I like the idea that I was meant to be something more. I always said that we're kind of the sum total of the decisions we make in life. And I just felt like I could very easily make the decisions that lead me away from that path of being more, whatever it is.
So Sean started planning a life beyond the paper mills, beyond Menasha. Antonio Damasio from the University of Southern California says Sean was doing something we all do. Although we're not aware of it, he says, we think about our own life as if it were a story in the making. That's how our brains are wired.
You're constantly rearranging the narrative of your life. And you're rearranging it, of course, as a function of the experiences that you have had and as what you imagine your experiences in the future ought to be.
Damasio is a behavioral neurologist. He says humans have a unique awareness that their own lives are stories that begin when we're born and end when we die. And because we know we're going to die, we are not satisfied with just surviving day to day. To give our lives meaning, we strive for what Sean calls something more. Damasio says you don't see that in other species.
I have enormous respect for non-human creatures, but I don't think we're going to get them to consider this something more that they can be or that they ought to be. And this is what humans clearly excel at.
It's that drive that pushes humans to do new things, explore distant lands, and build great civilizations. We're drawn to tales of remarkable people, Odysseus, Joan of Arc, Muhammad, Confucius. Sean always admired his father. He was a pragmatist who never gave up. But it was the people Sean saw on screen that would shape his own life story.
I just was always amazed that I could go in to this darkened theater, right? And somebody was able to make me cry, able to make me laugh, or make me able to just have these emotional rides.
One movie in particular inspired Sean, Excalibur. It retells the legend of King Arthur.
Merlin! Why have you done this to me?
Because you were born to be king.
What does it mean to be king?
You will be the land.
It just speaks of greater things than ourselves. I remember seeing it and just, it made me want to believe in destiny.
And it made Sean wonder, how could he make something special of his own life? King Arthur was destined to defend his country against the Saxons and search for the Holy Grail. Damasio says something happens to us when we absorb a tale like that.
We begin by being spectators of a story.
Sean sees Excalibur.
And then very rapidly we turn that into our own story.
Sean realized the Holy Grail was probably beyond his reach, and the Saxons weren't invading Menasha. So he focused on the quest for true love. King Arthur had his queen, Guinevere.
I had a couple girlfriends, but yeah, I got bored quickly. Like, it was easy to find fault and be like, is she really my queen?
Then he saw Heidi.
I was in the cafeteria, and I remember looking over, and I saw her walk in, and time kind of slowed.
Destiny. But for a chivalrous young man, there was a problem.
I was kind of stumped by the fact that I was a senior and she was a freshman, and that did not feel right.
So he decided to wait. He'd just be Heidi's friend until she was older. But it was hard. After 18 months, Sean decided he had to declare his love. He made Heidi a video. Picture a good-looking, all-American kid with a mullet, wide lapels, and a long-stemmed robe. He's lip-syncing to a song called Wait. He never showed it to her. Instead, he sent her an old-fashioned love letter. And soon, he got a letter back.
Dear Sean, you are the best friend I have ever had. And she underlined friend in an infinite line that was explicit that I would never cross over.
Sean was crushed. Setbacks aren't unique to humans, but Damasio says our response to them probably is. We see them as changing the plot line of the life story we thought we were writing. And we cope by coming up with a new narrative.
In any moment of the present, we are buffeted between the lived past, about which we cannot do anything, and the future, the what next.
The point is, humans never stop looking ahead to something better. King Arthur deals with his unfaithful queen by focusing on the Holy Grail. Sean rebounds from Heidi by imagining an entirely different future for himself. He's going to make it in the movie business. All through college, he works on that dream. By the time he graduates, he has an entry-level job with Disney all lined up. And then, on the very day Sean is to leave Menasha, the phone rings. His father takes the call. It's his father's doctor.
The doctor said, you know, it's stage 4 prostate cancer. You know, you got to come in. So that's kind of where my life went on pause.
Another setback, major. And this one was to last nearly 2 decades. But Sean never gave up on the life story he was determined to write for himself, which is why, many years later, he steps onto a stage in Hollywood.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sean.
Tomorrow, how Sean got through those 2 decades, and how bringing meaning to our own stories helps us cope with adversity and even death. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Let's pick up now with part 2 of Sean Parker's story, and we'll see how having a brain uniquely wired for storytelling has helped Sean shape his life.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sean.
Sean's waited nearly 20 years for this moment. He's standing on a stage in Hollywood, about to tell the audience how he got here.
Growing up, I loved movies. I love watching them.
Sean decided as a kid he wanted his life to be a story about more than just working in a paper mill.
There was one movie that came to define my view on life, and that movie was Excalibur.
Sean is telling his story as part of a show called Mortified.
Excalibur made me think that just like Arthur, that I had a destiny.
Grown-ups recount painfully funny experiences from adolescence. Neil Ketcher is executive producer of Mortified. He says telling stories can be a way of coping with adversity, even death. When we relive a painful event, it reminds us that eventually we feel better.
When we're children, we think a lot of things are going to kill us. We think that getting pantsed in gym class would kill us. We think that getting rejected by that crush would, you know, just, you know, be the end.
But of course, it's not. Today, Sean is describing how he tried to make his own life a bit like the story of King Arthur. His destiny would be true love, his own Guinevere.
And when I was 18, I was convinced that that destiny was Heidi.
Sean shows the cheesy video he made to woo her. And then he reads the Dear Sean letter she sent him. The audience is laughing and cringing because they see a bit of themselves in Sean. Hearing a story from this guy helps us feel better about our own stories of humiliations. Sean survives, so will we. Antonio Damasio is a behavioral neurologist at the University of Southern California. And he says whether we're watching Sean or Shakespeare, we use stories to gain a perspective on our own lives.
At the end of a great big drama in which everybody dies, you know that you're not going to die.
Damasio says stories serve another purpose, too.
But maybe you're going to take some lessons out of why on earth poor Hamlet got into the trouble he got and why he had to be turned into mincemeat.
So we do everything we can to make sure our own life stories turn out differently.
I realized maybe this was my grail, making videos.
The audience at Mortified loves that Sean uses his romantic failure to change his life. He talks about his plan to leave Menasha. Everyone is rooting for him. Then Sean's story takes another turn.
Out of nowhere, my dad got sick. And we were told time was precious. So I stayed where I was needed.
At this point, the 250 people watching Sean are totally silent. He isn't talking about being mortified anymore. He's talking about mortality. Sean has slammed into a major problem faced by our species. We know we're going to die, and we have to make that bearable. Damasio says stories are how we do that. Stories about an afterlife, and the stories we create in this one. The businesses we build, the children we raise, the books we write, the good we do.
All of these things are attempts by clever human beings to cope with fundamentally a rather bad deal, which is that you're alive, you enjoy your life, there are others that you love, they can be lost. How do you deal with it?
And Damasio says there's another way stories help us survive. When the present is grim, we look ahead to the part of our life we haven't lived yet and start writing that story.
When I'm talking to someone who is discouraged or depressed, I tend to say, don't let yourself be in this moment. Try to think instead about the possible future and try to be literally pulled by that future. Imagine something that you would like to achieve.
And that's what Sean did. But it wasn't his father's death he had to deal with. His father's illness, cancer, went into remission. Sean had to deal with staying in Menasha instead of going to Hollywood. Nearly 20 years passed. And during that time, the great future in movies that Sean imagined for himself evolved a bit. We're always rewriting our lives.
Man, if I could be, you know, just a storyteller, not having to be the main guy, but just to be part of it, to say, hey, I was part of that. I was part of something that moved you.
This draft of his future kept him going. He did some local improv. He learned about video editing. And one day, he started tinkering with that video love letter he'd made for Heidi. He watched himself as a young man lip-syncing to the heavy metal song Wait. And then, as he tells the audience at Mortified, he was able to use his computer to finally make his lips match the words.
And when I finally put it all together, I realized something. The Wait video wasn't necessarily a message to Heidi. It was a message for me to be part of something greater than myself.
And that wasn't happening in Menasha. So at the age of 37, Sean got in his car and headed for the land of dreams and palm trees. Before long, he met the people at Mortified. They helped Sean realize that the story he'd been working on his whole life was his own.
And here I stand before you, the newest and oldest production assistant of Fox Television's post-accounting division. Free insurance. And now, here are the final moments of the video that took nearly two decades to realize. I give you Wait as it was originally meant to be seen.
Neil Katcher, Mortified's executive producer, still remembers that moment.
The crowd just started cheering so loudly that you could feel the cheers sort of shaking the whole room.
I remember distinctly feeling, if nothing else ever happens for me out here, I have that moment that I stood in front of 250 strangers and I moved them.
Sean says that moment helps him accept the present, a present in which his father has died, he works as a clerk while looking for acting jobs, and he lives in a shoebox apartment.
Hey, guys.
Good morning.
This is the hovel.
But you are right on Santa Monica Boulevard.
I know. It's weird, right? Because there's so much money around me. It's just kind of strange then to have this tiny little place that this is what $575 a month buys you. So
it's not much. But to Sean, it's a pretty good place to start writing the next part of his story. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And that's all for On Science. We'll be back again next week. I'm Richard Harris. Thanks for listening.